Argument next in the case of United States against Hawkins.
May it please the court.
You always wait for everybody to have a chance to get a seat.
Just anxious to guy, I only got four.
Mr. Stern.
May it please the court. My name is Patrick Stern. I'm here for Monique Hawkins, and she is the petitioner, and this is on a second appeal. The first appeal, this court, different panel, reversed Judge McKinney and ordered the matter for resentencing. The judge then resentenced Ms. Hawkins and used a different wrong approach and came up with a wrong result. When I look
got
at the,
less time, though, didn't he?
Not significant, Your Honor. when you're wrong, Judge.
Well,
and
if you think it's insignificant, we can go back to the first verdict.
No, Judge, nothing is. Just because you give somebody a little bit of a break, I think that's what Judge McKinney thought. But I think what this court needs to do is follow this panel's opinion in the Freddie Booker case. I think Judge Posner wrote the right decision. If it affects sentencing, it has to be determined.
Booker was vacated by the Supreme Court, not affirmed.
Yes, it was. It was affirmed.
No,
of course
vacated.
It was affirmed. It was not vacated. It was affirmed.
I was there, too. I can't break this time.
But the decision.
You feel he doesn't justify it? You just take the pre-sentence report and say that's it? No. Is that your argument?
Judge, the pre-sentence report isn't evidence. It's the facts were so convoluted. The first time the court characterized McKinney as his novel approach, the sentencing guidelines are 0 to 6. What McKinney did was the first time he multiplied. Chief Judge McKinney multiplied the 6 by 4 and came up with a 24-month. The second time what he did was he just. The facts are so convoluted in this case. Monique Hawkins was charged in 6 counts. The count 5, she was got a not guilty on. Count 9, the jury come back and hung and was dismissed. The question becomes money. And if Monique Hawkins, if she decided to try the case in front of Judge McKinney, then Chief Judge McKinney could try the facts. She has a right to have the jury try the facts. As I indicated when I argued the resentencing in front of Judge McKinney, you can't determine the amount of money that was lost in this case. Now, in some of the cases that involve bank fraud, it's clear that the bank teller stole $123,000 from the bank. In this case, the loss was so convoluted that there's no way somebody with an advanced PhD from Wharton could figure out the amount of the loss. There's no the pre-sentence report. And when I sent my letter to the pre-sentence investigator, I indicated to him that there's no way you can determine any loss. The person that did the pre-sentence report did absolutely nothing. Nothing. There's not like you can determine loss in a financial crime. And when I argued the case originally, I said that I used the Podium example. If I fraudulently got an appraisal on this Podium for $100,000 and I sold it to you for $100,000 and you went belly up, and that was the exact example, and the Podium sold for $10,000, the loss would be clear $90,000. That would be a clear loss. You could tell that from the fact. But the facts in this case were so convoluted that, in fact, the people never really lost any money because the doctor that was involved in the deal held the properties. So the amount of money that somebody spent, the amount of money that you spent for this Podium, let's say in fact we get a break, that I fraudulently estimate this Podium at $100,000. I sell it to you, you buy it, you take it hook, line, and sinker, and to your amaze, when the auction goes, it brings $110,000. I still committed fraud on you by doing the false appraisal, but what happened was the circumstances changed and you actually had a pecuniary gain. Now the statute that triggers the upward departure is all based on pecuniary loss. And in this case, in order to determine pecuniary loss, which triggers the guideline, Chief Judge McKinney, the pre-sentence investigator, did none of this. And Ms. Hawkins has an absolute right under Booker, under Blakely, and under Apprendi that she has an absolute right for facts. The only exception was criminal history.
I'm lost. What do you mean she has an absolute right for facts?
If something affects sentencing, she has the right to have the jury determine that.
No, that's what Justice Stevens believed, but it's not the holding of the majority in Booker. Holding of the majority in Booker is that of Justice Breyer, and it said judges find facts. And as you, I'm sure, know, we've got an awful lot of opinions in this circuit saying that judges continue to find facts on the basis of the preponderance of the evidence. What happened in Booker was the sentencing guidelines are no longer mandatory.
Correct. Absolutely correct, Your Honor. I'm not disputing with
you. Continue to find facts. What's the problem?
They said if they affect sentencing, they have to be determined to the jury. Now, when they said that the judge, they said that you're entitled to a guideline calculation.
That's a deep misunderstanding. That's a deep misunderstanding. What is true is that having found facts and calculated a guideline sentence, the judge can then give a different sentence based on the sentencing factors in 18 U.S.C. 3553A.
You're correct, Joe. That's my position. In fact, when I made the argument on the resentencing to Judge McKinney, I said that the indication is under the guidelines. You have to give the person a guideline calculation. Now, there's nothing in any of the evidence that would show the amount of the pecuniary loss. You cannot glean that from any of this. Now, I indicated to Chief Judge McKinney that he could set the guidelines at a level 6 and give her an upward departure based on the facts.
There are no such things. They're gone, too.
But he can...
Outside the guidelines.
He could have given her a sentence outside the guidelines. He could have done that. But he still has to determine what the guidelines are. And if the facts affect the guidelines, there has to be some determination. Could he determine that there was a gun involved and add an extra 60 months on the back of his sentence, even though the jury never found that?
Yes, precisely. Yes.
I don't believe he could.
You don't understand. The judge, in order to calculate a guideline sentence, makes factual determinations, which may have completely unrelated to what the jury did.
I don't believe that's the case. In Blakely, Your Honor, I think what happened was, I think the original...
You completely misunderstand. Completely misunderstand. Right. Suppose there's an issue of relevant conduct, which is...
Yes, I think, by the way, something has gone wrong with our timekeeping. You're well over 5 minutes, which was your maximum.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I apologize. I saw the light.
Yes, I know. Something has gone wrong with our timekeeping. Yes. Mr. Schleppenbach.
May it please the Court, Jay Schleppenbach for Gerard Hawkins. Your Honors, Mr. Hawkins is appealing from his resentencing, and he requests that the sentence be vacated and the case remanded for two reasons. First, because the district court based its sentence on an incorrect factual assumption. And second, because the amount of loss finding in this case was not supported by a preponderance of the evidence. First, the incorrect factual assumption. At resentencing, the district court judge, in considering the amount of loss to be attributed to Mr. Hawkins, adopted the amount from the pre-sentence report, stating, quote, "The case has gone to trial, and that money was found to be a loss by the jury itself," end quote. That was the judge's only stated reason for adopting the pre-sentence report amount. However, that's simply not correct. The jury did not find the $1 million in the pre-sentence report. In fact, before...
He doesn't have to find any of these things.
That's correct, Your Honor. That's correct. But...
It's always comforting when lawyers think the judges are correct.
The jury did not have to find that amount, but the district court judge was operating under the mistaken assumption that it had. And when the district court was operating under that mistaken assumption, it throws the sentence into doubt. This court has, in previous cases where judges relied on mistaken factual assumptions, ruled that that the sentence could be vacated in the case remanded.
How was it pointed out to the district judge by your client or by you that the amounts were wrong?
Your Honor, the counsel at resentencing who was not me. The counsel at resentencing did object to the amount of loss.
Well, it takes more than just an objection. Did he say that's wrong and here's what it should have been?
The objection at resentencing appears to have been that none of the amount of loss should count towards the defendant's sentence.
But that obviously doesn't get anywhere. Doesn't one have to object? Doesn't one have to make the same kind of argument in the district court as one is making on appeal?
The arguments, I believe, are in the same neighborhood. They are both aimed at the amount of loss. And the waiver principles being liberally construed in favor of criminal defendants.
It's not a question of waiver. It's a question of forfeiture.
Yes. Yes. And therefore, this court can still review for plain error. I believe the error in this case was twofold. Also, there was not a preponderance of the evidence to support the sentence because the only evidence was the pre-sentence report, and that never laid out any evidence, but only a conclusion. In a previous case from this court, United States v. Lacknam, there was sort of a similar situation where there it was dealing with drug quantity, but the pre-sentence report only stated a conclusion without reasons, and the court only adopted that conclusion without reasons, and this court vacated and remanded, saying that that was not a sufficient evidentiary basis, did not meet the preponderance of the evidence standard.
The judge's decision was consistent with the pre-sentence investigation report.
Yes, that's correct.
So did the defendant say, you know, the pre-sentence report calculations were wrong?
Again, the defendant at that time was arguing that all of the money...
So your answer is no?
Yes.
Well, then it's sandbagging the judge, right? He assumes that, you know, if it's in the PSR, that's... fine, if no one objects, right?
I see my time has expired, Your Honor. If I may have leave just to quickly answer your question.
Sure.
I think the district court in this case was given notice of a problem with the amount of loss. The counsel below could have done a better job but didn't, and I don't think that should be construed against our defendant.
What does it mean to be given notice of a problem?
Well,
what if you say to the judge, you know, there's a problem here. I'm not going to tell you what it is, but there's a problem.
Well, certainly the objection could have been clearer.
I would love to see this in future cases. Every defendant would tender a sheet of paper saying, Your Honor, there's a problem, period. You're sincerely the defendant.
Well, I think the objection was a little more specific than that, but my time has expired, and I'll thank Your Honors for your time. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Pryor.
May it please the Court, my name is Doris Pryor, Assistant United States Attorney for the Southern District of Indiana. I represent the Attorney General, Alberto Gonzalez. In this case, both Monique and Jared Hawkins...
You represent the United States of America.
Sorry?
The Attorney General's not a party in this case, is he?
No, he's not, Your Honor. In this case, both Monique and Jared Hawkins waived any claim that the facts contained in the pre-sentence report were insufficient or inaccurate. Therefore, respectively, the government would argue that there is no appellate review. Even if the court determines that the appellants did not waive their objection, the judgment by the district court should be affirmed. This case involved a multi-million-dollar mortgage fraud scam that resulted in over $1 million in damages with numerous defendants and victims in the Southern District of Indiana. In determining the appropriate sentence for the defendants, the district court relied on the amount of money that each defendant gained through each fraudulent activity that he or she participated in over the years from 2000 to June 2002. Monique Hawkins argues on appeal that the district court erred in calculating her sentence. She seems to argue that her sentence was increased based upon facts not charged in the indictment or proven in violation of Apprendi. This argument, however, was made in United States versus Hale, where the court found this identical argument frivolous, holding that judges may continue to make factual findings by preponderance of the evidence when calculating a defendant's sentencing guideline range. Jared Hawkins also contends that the district court erred in relying on the amount of loss, however, on a different basis. He contends that the amount of loss in the pre-sentence report was not reliable or based on evidence. Again, this argument was not raised in the lower court. The objection that was made was that, at most, the amount of loss should not be counted at all. In order to trigger, the attorney was required to present a basis, and he has not done that. At no point during the sentencing did Monique or Gerard present any evidence to refute the facts contained in the pre-sentence report. In United States versus Purchase, the defense counsel challenged the factual findings of the defendant's pre-sentence report without presenting any evidence to support his argument. This court held that because the defendant had not presented any evidence to support his challenge to the pre-sentence report, the district court did not err in relying entirely on the facts.
Where did the probation department in the pre-sentence report get the information that ultimately determined the amounts?
The actual table that was provided was Government's Exhibit 1 that laid out all the fraudulent loans and
that
the
was in evidence
properties.
At trial.
Properties 1 through 10 was admitted into evidence. Property 20 and property 30 were admitted into evidence.
That was before the jury.
Yes, Your Honor. And all of these properties were presented during the trial.
Tied in with particular counts of the indictment?
Actually, Your Honor, the only parts of the indictment that were counted of the properties were properties 1 through 10, 20, and 30. The additional properties were not charged in the indictment, but were involved in the mortgage fraud scheme. If the court has no further questions, the government's rested on its brief and oral argument.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Ms. Pryor. Mr. Stern, Mr. Schleppenbach, you were appointed, and we thank you very much for your willingness to accept the appointment and the assistance you've been both to your clients and to the court. The case is taken under advisement.